You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the show where we're talking about Bitcoin. So today's guest is probably the biggest name in the entire Bitcoin space, and that's Dr. Adam Back. Dr. Back is the inventor of proof of work, which is one of the key components of the Bitcoin code base. In fact, Satoshi Nakamoto's original Bitcoin white paper referenced Dr. Back for his key contributions to make the blockchain even possible. Beyond his initial contributions, Dr. Back is the co-founder and CEO of Blockstream, which is a company that's a leader in innovation and foresight for the entire Bitcoin ecosystem. During this discussion, Dr. Back talks about some of his early discoveries, his opinion on proof of work and why it's important, some of the new initiatives at Blockstream to bring more mining capacity to North America, his opinion on the Bitcoin contango trade, and much, much more. So without further delay, here's my chat with the one and only Dr. Adam Back.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Here I am with the one and only Adam Back. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So Adam, I think the question I've been dying to ask you is just your discovery of proof of work for me is mind-blowing. And it's mind-blowing that this was incorporated straight into the white paper. Satoshi referenced you in the white paper. And I just try to put myself in your shoes and going back to the moment where you discovered this and kind of like what led up to it when you discovered it and you started to write about it. Like, what kind of utility did you think that it had at that time or at that moment? Just explain that moment to us as you discovered this.
I was running an anonymous remailer. So I got interested in cryptography and privacy, and basically deploying technology allowed users to exercise their rights and so on the online world. And so I was running this remailer, and at that time, this is the late 90s, obviously still today, there was a recurring problem with spam, where people would send bulk unsolicited mail, probably with a 1 in a million conversion rate, but hey, you know, sending an email was practically free. And it's kind of a bane, you know, most people's, anybody operating a mail server individually or as a company, the majority of the email that they were processing was spam. And it's also a nuisance for users too, because they have to sift through all this stuff to find the actual emails. And so that was going on in the background, but my particular concern was operating this remailer to get privacy, and it also had the ability to post to Usenet discussion groups, kind of broadcast decentralized kind of mailing list like technology chat forums. It seemed that there were people that were sending spam through the remailers, particularly to these discussion groups. And you know, once it hit these discussion groups, the Usenet technology broadcasts that across thousands of servers all over the world. So it's actually a way to amplify a denial of service. And it wasn't even commercial spam. It was just looked like random numbers and things. And talking amongst people who operated remailers on a cypherpunks list, our best theory was that people that were doing this were, you know, pro-establishment, anti-privacy, and just wanted to annoy the administrators of Usenet servers so that they would try to block remailers. So it seemed like an anti-privacy kind of, you know, create some nuisance so that there would be a blowback against remailers because people were spamming with it. So anyway, there's a kind of background problem then for remailers. Like, well, what do we do about this? And so usually what people do about spam is they put their system administrator hat on and they think, well, I'm the super user, which is more the case in those days, you know, big servers and not that many powerful desktops and laptops. And they would block IP addresses, block email addresses. But the actual protocol on the permissionless internet is there isn't really any concept of, you know, super user and regular user. Once you get onto the IP network, everybody is the same, right? So it struck me this was a bad and dangerous direction because it was pushing towards the internet driver's license concept, which resurfaces once in a while. You know, people want real names or personal information in order to get a cell phone contract or an internet connection. And so the whole point of the remailers was that you should have privacy in communicating person to person and particularly in discussion forums. So I had to look at the spam problem in it from a different direction, which is, well, the blocking identities and IP addresses isn't really a solution. It's kind of losing arms race. And anyway, dear, it's trending in a bad direction. What's the root problem? So the root problem is, well, email is practically free. So I was thinking, well, people on the Cypherpunk Explosive were already pretty excited and interested in electronic cash, but it was difficulties bootstrapping it because it relied on banking partner and that kind of thing. So some of the electronic cash protocols then were kind of centralized. You know, there would be a central server with a double spend it, like David Chaum's protocol, and there some other ones, a similar design. And actually, you know, PayPal didn't exist. Getting a credit card merchant processing account was difficult, complicated, and anyway, not a fit for sending private mails because identity, and it would also exclude lots of people, right? So, you know, billions of people in the world don't have credit cards and couldn't get a credit card merchant processing account, don't want to put their ID on things. And somebody's financial well-being, where they're happy to send, pay 10 cents or a dollar to send a message, maybe that's expensive for somebody. And we want to have a global, even discussion on Usenet about a wide range of topics. And so that's where, well, we can't use the banking rails. We can't pay them. So it's complicated. But could we at least add a cost to the sender? And so I had coincidentally been looking at hash collisions. So there's this concept called a birthday paradox, where if you pick a room of people and you say, what is the chance that two people share the same birthday? It's a much lower number than you expect, just a kind of statistical anomaly or counterintuitive fact. So with the hash functions such as SHA-1, SHA-256, similar kind of thing applies, except the cost. You know, you'd have to try lots of hashes until you find two that collide to the same output. The work to do that is impractical. You could run all the computers in the world until sun builds out and probably wouldn't find one or something. So if you did have one, if somebody from the far future came back and gave you one, you could instantly verify it, you know, a few thousand CPU cycles. So I thought that was a fascinating concept, which relates, right? Which is, well, you can prove that work was expended, but this is far too expensive. So maybe we can tune it and like modify the design of what's going on so that you can make it tunably expensive and still instantly verifiable. And so that's where Hashcash came from. And because it was for store and forward, like a communication mechanism where there's not, you know, a client and a server interacting, where the server says, please answer this challenge. And then you solve a capture and you send it back. I mean, a capture being another kind of thing that's used for this. But there's no client and server, it's broadcast. And the reader is not online at the same time as the sender, that kind of thing. So it was necessary for the sender to make a proof using a challenge that he chose himself. That made it a genuine proof rather than something that convinces only a server. It's a transferable proof. Anybody can verify that the person that posted this discussion comment spent a cent of electrical power doing so or something.
So when you said that you had to tune it, is this really similar to what we see with the difficulty adjustment, where it gets easier, it gets harder, depending on how much hashing power we see is on the network? Is that what you're talking about when you're saying you had to tune it?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. So with the Hashcash kind of email postage stamp, I had set it to 20 bits, which is about a million tries. So And that's a kind of fixed difficulty, but I had the concept that the verifier should increase the minimum postage they would accept every few years as CPUs got faster. And, you know, people started to do that. And so that is the difficulty adjustment. And of course, these are relatively cheap. It's in the context of electronic cash. Curiously, you know, when I posted this on a Cypherpunks list and a crypto list in 1997, is in a context where people were pretty excited. You know, electronic cash, David Chaum's eCash system was, you know, top of mind and a very exciting potential for the world sort of thing. Kind of Bitcoin-like vibe, but on a far smaller scale. But it was centralized and it was difficult to bootstrap. And so a lot of people looked at this and said, wow, this is interesting. It's like artificial scarcity. It's like digital gold. And then started having discussions about, well, how could you control the inflation? They were sort of hypothesizing that with Moore's law and an incentive to, you know, if you could do mining with this to create coins, that people would go nuts and make a ridiculous amount of coins, and that would erode, making it difficult to have a stable value. Mm-hmm. And so I think people were And, you know, by 1998, there were two kind of more detailed proposals being Wei Dai's B-Money and Nick Szabo's BitGold, which both used this proof of work and proposed ways to have a stable value, as it were, or a market set value, but in a kind of federated model with human market makers or sort of a council or supernode set of power users that would decide how much work was needed and or how many coins were going to be issued in the epoch, things like that. So if you scroll forward to 2008, when Satoshi started sharing drafts of the Bitcoin paper, it seemed to me that he'd cracked the one thing that people hadn't figured out how to do back then, which was, you know, in hindsight, it looks simple, but it's to say, well, let's not try to target a stable value, but let's instead target a predictable supply curve and let the market worry about the value. And that, it turns out, is technically possible to do inside a distributed system with no, you know, human councils or supernodes and governance and deciding how many coins per epoch and that kind of thing.
It was funny, this Johns Hopkins professor that just keeps on bagging on Bitcoin just published an article, I think it was in CNN just this past week, where he was talking about these governance structures. And I'm thinking to myself, dude, the entire point of this is to not have a governance, some people involved in the loop of managing this. It's like, how can people not see that this, I mean, Bitcoin is many things, but like that is one of the chief things that like this is all about, is not having that. It's just crazy.
Even some Bitcoin technologists, technical commentators will talk about governance, by which they mean the change process within Bitcoin. But I personally take exception to that terminology. You know, there is no governance. The change process within Bitcoin is opt-in, backwards compatible optimization and features. And there's certainly no economic or core system metrics that there's any plausible governance discussion to be had about. So Bitcoin has no governance, I would say. You know, some consensus. Other altcoins. Yeah, I mean, you know, Ethereum has governance because there's a group of people that are sort of graphed somewhere off the supply curve, and it's all over the place. There's labels on it where different people decided different things, right? So I think actually Plan B said something interesting as a way to explain this, because it's mathematical and software, people have difficulty understanding why it's inviolable. Like they think, well, you know, the software could be changed. And his analogy was that it's a game of chess, the game of chess. You could change the rules, but nobody will play with you if you do, right? So you could make a modified piece of software with a different number of coins per block or something, and nobody's interested in playing that game. So the economic consensus just continues.
So Adam, going back to the discovery here, what is the time frame when you get this aha moment about proof of work prior to even Hashcash, where you were just like, I think this might solve this problem? Where are we at in the timeline?
That was in May 1997, I think. And I'd been reading about these hash collisions on Usenet, coincidentally, on a crypto list, and kind of found it interesting. I was looking at the mathematics of it. In the background, there's this ongoing spam war waging in general email, and a bit of it creating a kind of a political problem for remailers, which I was one of the operators of a remailer. And so it occurred to me, I spent, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 days thinking about design variants of how to do it. And then I was thinking, well, I could post this. This is interesting. I think this would be the right design variant to use. And then I thought, well, you know, in the ISEF process, you should have running code first. So I shut up and wrote the code for a couple of days and I posted it. And so it was, you know, here's the code, here's a description of how it works. And that was on a mailing list. And there's lots of discussion, you know, people integrate it into remailers and actually into a lot of different things. Even pseudonyms, sort of cost to create a persistent pseudonym, which is a bit like vanity addresses in Bitcoin. And as sort of storage denial of service protection in distributed file systems. And actually, over time, Spam Assassin, which is a common kind of ISP-grade anti-spam filter, added support for hashcash postage stamps in the headers. So it would give you some negative scoring. So it's trying to grade, is this spam? So it looked for spamminess metrics, And, you know, if it had make money fast plus 20 to the score, this is probably spam, right? It had a valid hash cache header in it. Big negative, this is not spam, right? So it would protect you from being falsely categorized as spam, which happens too, right? So they did that on the server side, and Microsoft made a system as well and integrated it into their whole suite of email things, you know, the clients, the Outlook mail server, things like that. But their protocol was essentially the same thing, but a slightly different format. So it wasn't cross-compatible. That was that kind of technology. I didn't actually get around to writing a paper describing it more formally until about 5 years later. I'm generally more interested in building and deploying
action
things.
Yeah. You're interested in action and actually doing it. I love that theme about you. And I've seen you post that on Twitter from time to time. It's like, hey, we can sit around and talk about things, or we can actually create this and get things done. And that's a cool story that you're kind of showing that's what you did from the very early days, is that you coded it out and you put it out there before you really kind of even formally described what was actually happening with the code that you were publishing. I want to summarize something and just correct me if my understanding of this is wrong, but when I think about what this discovery really kind of meant, this proof of work discovery, and especially how it applies today, I was taking this online course. I think it was like this free Princeton course. It was like 70 hours, just teaching you like all the nuances of like how Bitcoin works behind the scenes. I don't fully understand the encryption. I know that the mathematics to take SHA-256 make it applicable so that if there's five people running five processors and the difficulty is being scaled down for SHA-256, that math to do that to me is just a mind-blowing event. Like, that's just like, I can't imagine trying to program or work out the math on how you would figure out statistically how to adjust SHA-256, which, like you had said earlier, you could have all the processors in the world running on it till the sun goes out, and you're not going to have this event where you're having the same input produce the same output, right? So when you're thinking about scaling that difficulty down to now there's five people guessing and they can figure it out in a 10-minute time period, the math that's associated with doing that scaling down to me is an amazing feat. And that's pretty much what your proof of work discovery was all about, is what I just described. Is that an accurate description of how you would put it into layman's terms for people that are kind of listening to what this means and how it's really kind of applicable to Bitcoin?
So I think the point is the full collision, we know how to do it, it's just too expensive. And so to make it simpler, faster, and tunably expensive, it's almost definition change, right? So we're saying, okay, we give up. We're not going to find a full collision. It's far too expensive. But how about if we find a partial collision where, you know, the first 10 bits or 20 bits are by chance all zero? And so that's what I did. And I mean, you know, zero is good as any number. It could be a magic string, could be anything, but you're trying to reach a target, and effectively by looping on a hash function, changing a counter in it, you're sort of throwing 256 coins and looking if the ones at the beginning all landed heads. And of course, that's very unlikely the more heads you get, right? But if it's 20, then it's going to take, say, half a second on a CPU at that time. And if you want that to increase, you know, if you want the time, if you want to stay at like a minute of work after computers have doubled in speed, then you're probably going to want it to increase it to 21. And so with Hashcash, I had a kind of crude graduation of the amount of work. So it would only either double or half, but it's pretty straightforward to make it take 1.5 times longer. You just put a floating point representation of a number in there and say, is it less than this? And that'll do it. And that's what Bitcoin does. So I think how Bitcoin targets the interval is more like a control system. It's like a feedback loop, right? So you start the system, you take a guess at a number, you start the system running, and then you measure over a period, what is the average time between blocks in this, you know, across this 2000 block period? And you're saying, oh, it's 5 minutes. I want it to be 10. Let's double the difficulty. That'll fix it, right? And if it goes in the other direction, you reduce it. So it's just a control system where you measure and adapt, measure and adapt.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host two live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And I actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
You hear all these different narratives. You hear all these different opinions on what's going to work in the long term. You hear a lot of people actually bash Bitcoin because it's using proof of work. And I've always had the opinion, which is the polar opposite of that, that proof of work is the essence of why Bitcoin's going to work, because you actually have to perform. If we're using a comparison to gold, you have to actually go out there with your shovel and dig through the Earth's crust and perform work in order to find whatever probability per dig. Let's say you got to do 100 digs to find whatever amount of ounces of gold. You have to do that work in the physical realm in order to create value behind what gold is, because it's so scarce and hard to find. So why would that be any different when we move into the digital realm, that there doesn't have to be some type of work performed in order to create value behind the units that are being mined? When I look at these other protocols and they're not doing these things and they're just, there's just this pre-mine or there's this proof of stake and all these other things, to me represents more of what we've already got in today's society with fiat currencies than it does something that is hard, sound, immutable, fungible money. Assuming you agree, but is there anything that you want to add on to that, or do you believe that proof of work is really required for this to be successful in the long run?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that economic game theory is counterintuitive, even to people with a background in economics, right? So there are some very interesting effects here. So, I mean, one thing that I think there's, if you scroll through Satoshi's old writings, he had said something like, yes, it uses electricity, but as with gold, it's far more efficient to the world to have a hard money versus the kind of slippage and churn that happens when you have political money. And then Another comment I've heard is Paul Storz made the observation that there is an economic incentive to obtain money. And so people are willing to expend up to the commodity cost to obtain it. And if there is no clean cost, that effort will be expended in other ways, i.e. in political lobbying, favoritism, audits, physical bank security, cross-checks, controls, theft, insider double dealing, inefficient political systems. So we haven't saved a thing. What we've done is we've had a messy, uneven playing field. I think another thing that's interesting is Eric Voskwill. I had a discussion with him where I concluded that actually he was right in some degree, that people look at, they look at the world as if a cost arose ab initio, but there's no cost that doesn't have an alternative. So, you know, they say, well, the electricity was used to mine Bitcoin. Okay. But there was a foregone alternative, right? Instead of mining the Bitcoin, maybe they would have engaged in some other consumerish behavior. They would have bought a car. And so no energy was solved. You know, maybe Bitcoin is probably actually reducing a number of pollutive and carbon producing things in the world. For example, it's clearly reducing gold mining, because I think people are starting to realize that gold prices will probably be higher if Bitcoin was not monetizing in the alternative. And gold, you know, gold mining is extremely industrial and chemical process. So I think that there is probably some necessary inevitability for the production of money to have, or of a hard money to have, an actual economic cost.
So Adam, when we think about this, and whenever I'm looking at the price curve, the thing I just keep coming back to, and the thing I keep asking myself, is how in the world, because here I am, I'm a finance guy, I'm looking at stocks, I love stock investing, and I've never in my life seen a price chart that looks like Bitcoin. I've never seen something that almost looks like it grinds and has like this perfect shape on the bottom of the price chart over a 10-year period of time. And I know a lot of people in the community don't like to necessarily call it that it looks like Metcalfe's law for various reasons, because you're comparing something that's a little bit different. But when you look at that price chart and you look at it in log terms, it looks like Metcalfe's law playing out in real time, but it's a price chart. And I'm telling myself, okay, what in the hell is driving this to happen? There's something mechanically that's happening in the code that's causing this to play out. And the only thing that I can arrive at is, because when you look at these peaks that happen in the price action, it doesn't seem like it's bound. It looks like it's more emotional. But when you look at the floor of the price action, there's these moments where it almost seems like it's just grinding through something that's forcing it to go up. And so the only thing that I can come to the realization, and I go back, there's an awesome book called The Book of Satoshi that I've read, and it's pretty much all of Satoshi's writings that was pulled from online. And one of the quotes in there that really stuck with me is he really gets into something that you just described, which is this labor theory of value might actually be playing out with Bitcoin. And you talk to any economist and they'll roll their eyes at this labor theory of value. They'll say that's clearly not something that actually works in reality, especially when you get into specialized services, like say you're a doctor or whatever, like that's just not something that's applicable. But I think when you look at Bitcoin and you look at the mining process and you look at how commoditized the mining process is and how competitive it is, it's really kind of the electrical cost to mine these things that's setting the price floor, especially when you look at the scarcity that keeps getting tighter and tighter, like a noose around, like a collar around a dog that just keeps getting tighter and tighter every 4 years. So this is my question. Is proof of work driving this price floor because of the electrical costs that are associated with the flow of Bitcoin that's being dropped into the market and how much tighter it gets every 4 years?
I think the complete inelasticity of the supply curve is interesting, right? Because if you look at any other commodity, the people who are extracting the ore or producing the finished product are going to react to market conditions. If the price of gold is up, they'll reopen mines that have an expensive per gram production cost. they'll work shifts. People will like recycle, reclaim gold from electronics. I mean, everything will ramp up to the max. It take the edge off the price increase a little bit. And similarly, if the price is depressed, they'll shut everything down and it will provide some, it'll take some edge out of the selling because there's less to be bought as well. Bitcoin in comparison, you know, people say Bitcoin doesn't care, which is more insightful than it sounds, right? But it kind of applies here too, right? It's like the price is up. Bitcoin doesn't know that actually. So it just keeps producing coins. And the miners, of course, they will chase a higher cost by being economically incentivized to bring more miners online and so forth. It's an interesting question to what extent miners sell coins to pay electricity bills. And, you know, at Blockstream and me personally as well have been doing mining for about 5 years now. And conclusion is that it's better, like, backtested, dispassionately backtested. It's just a better financial strategy to hold the coins and not sell them. People will say, well, how could you do that? Like, where does the money come from? And I say, well, look, you're about to invest some dollars in mining. Some of that's going to go into equipment and some of it's going to go into electricity. So if you've got $100,000 or $1 million, calculate the ratio between the equipment and the electricity you'll need to run it for 3 years. And instead of, you know, spending all of your money on miners and then saying, oh no, I have no money left, I'm going to sell the coins to pay for electricity, you're better off to mine at, let's say, half the size, where you've got half the money set aside to pay the electricity bills. And you can talk about more why that is, but basically, I think that mining has some downside protection as compared to buying. So buying and holding is very sensitive to the entry price, and that catches new people. They look at the price and they're like, well, I've been hearing about it. It's in the news again. I want to establish a Bitcoin position, but now, is this a good price? You know, should I wait for it to fall? Will it just go up? So they get frozen in indecision, right? And so with mining, it's interesting because you don't care as much about what happens. If the price goes up rapidly, you tend to get a derivative benefit because there'll be a shortage of miners, or people can't manufacture new miners fast enough to bring them online. So you'll get a kind of derivative premium for a while until that catches up. And that's the current state of the market, really, is it? Last year, miner sales were kind of weak, but this year it's really hard to acquire new miners without very long forward delivery dates. And if you started mining and the price falls, you would think that's bad. But actually what tends to happen is price is falling. And so some miners will switch off because they fall below their break even. And so as that falls, if you keep mining, you know, you've got a cost basis that allows you to keep mining, or you've pre-funded the investment, right? You've got the capital to pay for the electricity and you're going to mine through it. Obviously, you're not going to mine below the cost of buying Bitcoin with electricity. That wouldn't make sense. But there's a big hysteresis between the equipment break-even and the initial investment. So that's typically fairly far off. So you end up mining more coins than you expect through the bottom of the market. And then, well, let's say the market recovers somewhat. So we did one coincidentally where when we started, the Bitcoin price was around $15,000. If you had bought, that would have been your entry price. And when we finished, when these machines reached end of life, the price was about $7,500. And so if you bought and hold, you'd have made a 50% loss in cash terms, Bitcoin. But with mining, we ended up making a 25% profit in dollars. And you wonder, like, well, how could that be? And so you go back, test a bunch of things and try and figure out a pattern of what's going on here. And the point was, price fell all the way down to 3,500, which gives you an indication of this period. And we mined a lot of coins at prices below 3,500, because, you know, you're generally mining at a discount or you stop. And then the price recovered to 7,500. And that was enough to push us into, you know, the discount on mining, plus the fact that we got more coins than we expected because the price really fell a long way in the middle of it. So I think generally what you see is it's less sensitive to entry price or timing. You have some downside protection. You still have a fairly good upside participation. Like, we've seen across the periods we backtested, it averaged about 60% upside participation as compared to buying, just buying and holding Bitcoin. So for the trade-off, I think, you know, that's an interesting trade-off, better than being frozen in indecision, let's say, right? For people who are new to Bitcoin or looking to establish a position.
When you say 60% upside, that's on an annualized basis?
No, sort of absolute return across a three-year period. I mean, of course, there are many periods where buying and holding outperforms. I mean, Bitcoin's price history is nothing but exponential, but it's also volatile. So the point being that you experience less volatility by doing mining. And there are people, you could say, well, you know, look, Bitcoin has performed well over all three previous X year periods, right? And that would be statistically the case, but that's still unnerving prospects for people who are not used to Bitcoin, haven't adapted, right? I mean, we've both, you know, participated in different conventional markets, and there's enough volatility in those, but Bitcoin at times takes that to a whole different level, right? So I think that the reduced volatility of mining versus buying, and the prospect that there's downside protection and some upside participation, a pretty reasonable upside participation at 60% statistically, is something less scary than full Bitcoin. Of course, some people would, you know, do a mixture. And other than newcomers who don't have a Bitcoin position, the other type of investors we've seen be interested to do this are people who actually are very deep in Bitcoin, almost felt overexposed to Bitcoin. And so they had some dollars and were interested to do something Bitcoin correlated, but with more downside protection. And yeah. So that made sense to them as well, but for a very different reason. I think another reason to do mining is, as we were talking about earlier, Bitcoin gets some of its value from being permissionless and decentralized. And so if mining becomes too centralized, that could expose it to governance-like risks, right? And so I think if you look at the Bitcoin market cap and you work out what it would take invested in mining, what percentage of that it would take to, on an individual basis or on a whole system basis, it's only a couple of percentage points of the, let's say, $1 trillion in market cap as composed to a handful of billions in mining equipment and electrical spend. So, you know, one approach, and that was my personal philosophical point of jumping into doing some mining on more than a hobby basis myself, was, well, maybe I should be part of the solution and operate some of the mine. I mean, not physically hand on, but, you know, they're my miners, so I can say if something dramatic is happening, I can instruct the service provider, look, I want you to do this with my miners, and they're going to do it.
That's an interesting point. And I just want to kind of summarize, especially for a lot of the finance and investing types that are listening to this. In short, what you're really getting at is this is giving you a better Sharpe ratio by investing because you don't have as much volatility. And you're saying that over a three-year period of time, you have demonstrated through backtesting, which doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be what it is moving forward, that you've had a 60% outperformance. So if you're having less variance in your price, you're having an outperformance, that's going to give you a higher Sharpe ratio than if you would just buy the underlying. And that's something to be said, because when we look at the Sharpe ratio on Bitcoin, and I know the Sharpe ratio I've looked at is over four-year periods, but it has literally outperformed everything, every financial asset on the planet over the last 10 years,
right.
Which is something to be said. So that's a really interesting stat.
Well, I mean, I would say what you said is accurate, but I would emphasize that the expected return is lower by mining, but a Sharpe ratio measuring the trade-off between investment return and volatility, it has reduced your volatility by more than it has reduced your return.
Yeah.
And maybe that's attractive to some people, or they'd like a little bit of a lower risk. Of course, the other thing, you obvious thing you can do with risk, which is the way some people talk about Bitcoin for newcomers, is to say, well, by 1-5% from the point of view, you know, your stock portfolio is moving around, you're uncertain about lots of factors in today's world. So what's the worst that can happen? You could lose 1-5%. And looking at the other factors you're looking at, including M2 money supply expansion and probable double-digit asset price inflation, trying something at a 1-5% ratio that may improve that. It's just an asset allocation, you know, mixing a high Sharpe ratio asset with higher volatility. It may repair your returns if things go badly. So that's another thing, just asset, I mean, portfolio allocation.
So Adam, what are you guys doing from a Blockstream lever? Is this all internal as far as just you're using your own retained earnings in order to invest in this? Is this something you're going to open up to the market? that people can participate in it with you as well through equity or through debt somehow? What's your approach moving forward for this?
How we started was sort of about 50-50 internal investment, use of companies, cash reserves, and actually converted a bunch of US dollars into Bitcoin. So Bitcoin holdings increased through that. And the other was hosting for high net worth individuals and institutions. So there were Reid Hoffman as an individual, and Fidelity was one of the hosting customers. And there have been more that have been announced over time. So a number of the recognized brand name institutions in this space who are doing mining, many of them don't have physical operations, so they will host equipment to us. Something else we've had, we're interested in decentralization, and us doing some sort of institutional and in-company mining is a form of macro decentralization, right? We're doing it in Canada or the US. We're a new voice. So, you know, if there are 50 institutional miners instead of 49, that's a small amount of decentralization, but, you know, it's not very end-user decentralized. And so we have seen a lot of ongoing requests from individuals to say, hey, can I buy $10,000 worth of mining, or can I buy $100,000 worth of mining? And that was something that we were interested to do, but weren't set up to do at the beginning. So we set about trying to address that problem and meet that demand. So more recently, we have offered something called the Blockstream Mining Note, which tries to do that. Now, on a regulatory basis, it's only available to non-US investors. And there's a qualification criteria, which where the minimum investment has to exceed 125,000 euros. Again, this is for non-US investors. But, you know, it does bring the barrier down.
Adam, just for clarification, you said it's a note?
Yeah, so it's actually, I think it's the first of its kind, actually. We worked with a company called Stocker in Europe that is a kind of regulatory specialist, and they are the registration agent for this. It's a Luxembourg securitization vehicle. And so it has a foot in both worlds. So it's both a Luxembourg securitization vehicle with an ISIN, an investment serial number. And so, you know, you could potentially give that to a broker that deals with, you know, a longer tail of assets and say, how can you hold this as part of my portfolio? Can you margin lend against it? That kind of thing is all possible if you have a more bespoke brokerage. But it's also an asset in a cryptocurrency tokenization sense. So it's a liquid security token. So it's an STO.
I right? love it.
And
yeah. This is awesome. Okay.
So the security token it all implies some quite interesting things for, you know, people who are able to access it regulatorily. One is that you can potentially transfer it OTC. So after the issuance phase, there are some different limits that apply later. So it can be transferred down to 0.01, but only to qualifying users. And to be a qualifying user, the user has to register on Stocker, and they are the registration agent for these transfers. But there's no kind of conventional stock transfer agent fee, only kind of network fees, which are de minimis. And so you could gift somebody a BMN or part of a BMN. You could swap it OTC, and there are, you know, smartphone wallets that let you do that. So it's kind of private OTC scenario. And there are some exchanges which we are working with that may end up being in a position to list STOs going forwards. And so in that sense, they would be a kind of nominee ombudsman holder of these notes. So the notes, the registration agent would be in the name of that exchange. And then the exchange would reflect the qualification requirements onto the users. So it'd be accessible to a subset of the users, i.e. not in the US and reaching some level.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
All right, so I have a million questions here. So you said that it's through Stalker that you're registering for your ownership of the note, which is a token on Liquid. How is the maturity of this? And is there a coupon? Is it couponless? I'm assuming it's, would this be a, there would be no coupon being paid. You would just get a kind of a payout at the maturity date.
Right. So we had some quite a bit of internal design discussion about the mechanism, jurisdiction, tax planning. So there's quite a lot that goes into this. But yes, so it's couponless. So there's no Bitcoin being dividended out of it. So the Bitcoins roll up inside until maturity, and then they're paid out in Bitcoin to the holder at the time of maturity.
So you hold this token. What's the maturity on these?
36 months.
36 months. So I could buy it 12 months after it's already been issued, for whatever price it's trading for on the open market. And then I hold it. Let's say I hold it through maturity. At that time, the token just disappears and Bitcoin shows up in a wallet that's registered with that specific token. Is that how that would work?
Yeah. If it's on an exchange, they would probably take care of that for you. If you are holding it in a wallet, you'd probably need to go to Stalker and, you know, deposit the token.
Turn it in.
A Bitcoin address, kind of like, you know, having a oil future, you got to take delivery at the end, right?
So now are you guys going to go through just one issuance? Or are you going to go through multiple issuances to just kind of continue funding? And it sounds to me a little bit like what you had previously described, where half of whatever you guys are generating, you're putting into hardware, and then the other half you're retaining as payments for the electrical expenses, which is kind of your maybe derivative strategy in order to make sure that your electrical costs have kind of like a predictable curve to them. Is that how you're kind of going about it from like a strategic sense?
Part of that is back-tested, right? So we're thinking, based on our own experience, prop mining, that this is a better way to do it economically, as opposed to spending your capital allocation on the miners and then paying as you go or selling Bitcoins as you go. So we put those economics into the note because we want the note holders to have a positive economic outcome so they buy more of them, basically, right? So it's kind of a win-win formula. And it's exactly like you say. So, of course, the price is bundled. So how you ascribe value to the cost of the miners versus the remaining duration on a hosting contract is a matter for, you know, the market to decide ultimately. And over time, of course, it's got an additional makeup, which is the number of coins per note. And, you know, there's a dashboard where you can see that on a fairly real-time basis. Now, you asked another question, which is, do we issue more? So yes, we are intending to issue about $100 million, so 85 million euros of this series. And they are, so even though they're issued at different times, we do some clever things to achieve fungibility between them so that they are, you know, all interchangeable, and you shouldn't care as an investor whether you bought an early sales tranche versus a later sales tranche versus in the market. And that's quite interesting to actually achieve, because, you know, this first 12.5 million sales tranche is power update early July. And let's say there's another tranche that sold in September. For that to be equal, it has to have a 33-month hosting contract, and we have to market by the number of coins per note that the miners that have already been running have achieved, right? And so that's what we do.
So I would think that you would do it in a way where, let's say you have your first tranche, whatever you raise through that initial tranche, that has dedicated servers that are basically partitioned, saying, hey, this amount of processing power is dedicated to this tranche of funding. And then as the next tranche comes in, whatever servers that are associated, I'm saying servers, but really kind of processing power and terahashes or whatever it might be, is dedicated to this tranche of funding. Am I understanding it correctly, that that's how it's being managed?
So no, it's actually all interchangeable. Once, think about it like pool of capital that's mining, and there's a certain economic makeup of the per note value. So let's say it's August, they've been running for a while, there's a certain proportion of Bitcoin per note, there's now not 36 but 35 months left to run on the contract, so the, you know, the value of the hosting contract's gone down a bit, the Bitcoin have a market value, and the machines have, you know, some depreciation scale of value, right? And now it rolls over to September, and we want to add some more nodes which are interchangeable with the running nodes. And so what we do is try to match the economic characteristics of the existing nodes. So we say, okay, let's look at the makeup. It has a defined number of Bitcoin. We can fix that. We just go market buy that many Bitcoin. It has 35 months left to run on the hosting contract. We'll give it a 35-month contract.
I see how you're doing. Yeah.
And then machines should be comparable, right? But it's defined in terms of hash rate. So even if, you know, these machine shortages mean that sometimes you want to take what you can get, right? So if the machines that come online are 42 joules instead of 38, like they're less efficient, it's still fungible because the definition is in the hash rate target of what it's producing, right? So it will mean that, you know, maybe we pay slightly less for the machines, but expend slightly more power, but it's still interchangeable because the finished product is the hash rate you get from it.
But at any point in time, post the initial issuance, let's say we're 3 months into the ownership of this, I can look at how much Bitcoin has been mined that's associated with that note. Is that correct?
Right. And it's actually the same for all of the nodes, because it's kind of harmonized. You know, there's a pool of hash rates, so it's averaged, but there is a defined, this is how many coins have been mined per note or in aggregate, and this is how many notes there are. And, you know, another question people ask is, well, what if I want to sell the coins, you know, because I can't extract them? And so you can sort of synthesize the equivalence of there being a Bitcoin coupon by, you know, if you have additional Bitcoins outside, you could just sell those instead. Something else you could do, you know, we were talking earlier about yield strategies, is you could, assuming there are exchanges which honor the BMN notes as collateral, you could short Bitcoin using it as collateral to the tune of the number of coins per note. And that would even, you know, that would be equivalent to selling, right? Because it would lock in a dollar value, plus it would give you a yield typically resulting from, you know, kind of Bitcoin perpetual products, right?
Wow. So this is such an interesting approach, and it's so much different than participating in a mining pool or just going out and buying equity in a mining company. It really has a feel that you are really participating in the funding of hardware and then getting the kickback of whatever that hardware is pumping out. Fascinating. I'm really curious, why not in the US? I think I know the answer that you're going to say, but I'm curious, what's the reason that you were not able to do this in the US?
We may be able to in future. It's just there are different regulatory requirements, and that's further process. And I mean, I think so you mentioned a couple of things there. One is that you are not, buying shares in a mining company. So this is more like a non-discretionary financial instrument. So that you're not relying on some management discretionary decision. If you put money into buying shares in a prop mining company, now you are, exposed to, well, did they make a good decision? Did they decide to use your money to expand a farm over there? Or, sell some coins to dollars because the price is falling, or pay out a management bonus, or pay out a dividend or not. None of that stuff applies, right? It's all non-discretionary defined. What's happening? There's extremely thin deterministic behavior, and it's kind of like a Bitcoin ETF, but it's kind of like, it's not an ETF, but it's something in that direction where there's a defined thing that does something very thinly managed.
I'm kind of curious. So let's just say I buy $1,000 worth of this note. When are you expecting over that 3-year time frame for the person to break even on the principal of the $1,000 based on backtesting?
So I think obviously it's difficult because there are so many exponentials that go into the Bitcoin world, price, the high volatility, the hash rate is prone to like really actually even exceed price because you've also got a factor of more modern equipment being developed over time that has a higher hash rate per joule. So I think, one thing we can do is look at the backtesting with a caveat that the future doesn't guarantee that, and say that, it hasn't lost money over previous 3-year periods, that it has this 60% upside participation as compared to buying and holding. But what is very defined is the short term, because Bitcoin has a fully liquid market price. The current difficulty is, you can look at it, that's verifiable. And you can infer from that what your, mined Bitcoin revenue would be. So the notes, the list price of the note, of course, that may change based on the inputs later, is 200,000 euros. So that's actually the minimum investment. And if it were running now, I would say that would produce about 20,000 euros per month. So it's, if the metrics went such that it was straight line, you would see a break even at 12 months.
Yeah, about a year. And that's intuitively, that's kind of what I was expecting to hear you say. It was about a year time frame.
Right. And so, of course,
it all depends.
It's not as volatile as Bitcoin, but it's still volatile. So you've got to like buckle up going into these things, right? And that can go both directions, right? So if you scroll forward to some of these stock to flow derived price targets, or just price targets people have thrown out, or comparators between previous halving lows and highs, or cycle lows and highs, $300,000 price into next year, of course, the profitability is going to be through the roof because nobody can manufacture that amount of equipment in that time frame. Like, there isn't enough foundry capacity in the world. If you manage to, seize all the capacity that's being used to build smartphone chips and so forth, which is hard to compete with in terms of their command of capacity, basically. But of course, if that were to happen, I think it's fair to say you would have done even better if you just bought Bitcoin and held it now, right? But in the alternative, there are certainly people looking at the market now and saying, wow, $60,000 is a high price, so I'm scared to buy. And they get stuck in the indecision cycle. So now, as an alternative to that, I think it's a pretty reasonable trade-off.
I'm kind of curious on the stalker thing. Are they doing this with equity as well, where they're assisting in the issuance of tokens for equity?
Yeah, so they are a company that specializes in that area. So they do the KYC. They are a Luxembourg securitization, licensed Luxembourg securitization manager. I don't know all the correct terminology, but they're experts in that domain. And they do fundraisers for these kind of, it's called a non-public investment in Europe. And so one they did is for a supercar called Mazzanti. So it's an Italian kind of bespoke custom supercar company that's equity in the company or something like that, or equity or proportion of revenue, something I didn't look into all the details, but they are doing things like that. Another one is Infinite Fleet.
Yeah, Samson was telling us about this. So that's how he's doing it, is through, it makes sense now. Okay, so let's transition to real fast here. And I know your time is limited and I want to be respectful of that. I just want to hear, what is the biggest news you've seen this year, or something that really kind of made you go, oh, wow?
it seems like the metrics and institutional sort of almost stampede to participate is, you know, there's something new every day or two, right? Big fund managers, big banks, where the CEOs have been skeptical. It's just
Right? They're writing stock to flow charts now from Fidelity.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting to see. I mean, of course, the adoption level is still fairly low. The treasury disclosures are interesting too, that Michael Saylor kind of encouraged people to do. I mean, it's something we've actually been doing since 2014, which is when we were incorporated. So, and that obviously works pretty well, right? We got the equivalent of probably a couple of rounds of investment through Bitcoin price appreciation and invested dollars into mining. That was also highly profitable in dollar terms and putting more Bitcoin on the balance sheet. So I think it's an interesting sort of precursor to transitioning to a Bitcoin monetary base if that happens, or at least a kind of alternative store of value, right? Because I think sometimes people overemphasize that fiat currencies have fallen, even the best of them, 99% over a 100-year timeframe, right? But nobody in the investment space says you should put, you know, cash under the mattress, right? So it's not really a useful comparison. So I think maybe gold is an interesting comparison. And Bitcoin may, I guess, in the long term, do a little better than gold, even at the top of an S-curve, you know, after fully adopted, whatever level that is, you know, if that's 100 trillion or 200 trillion, 5 to 10 million a coin, even then, because the, you know, having displaced lots of different sort of artificially monetized goods like, you know, stocks, real estate, artwork, gold, things where people are not buying it for the enjoyment of it, but they're buying it to preserve capital or to, in the expectation of price appreciation by other people seeking to do the same thing. So even in that case, I think it would outperform gold because it's strictly scarce, where, you know, there's always more gold. So the supply inflation should taper off to well below gold, I guess is my point. Just the sequence of positive news is just really keeps going. That's pretty interesting.
So you and I have exchanged some messages with Plan B in the background about this Contango trade. And what I find fascinating is you're seeing this pretty much only materialize, or these spreads, these large spreads between the spot and the future price materialize on physically settled exchanges. When you get into the cash settled exchanges, it doesn't seem like that this is happening. But with the size of some of these physically settled derivatives exchanges all over the world, which are massive, billions and billions in size, what is causing this? Is this going to continue to persist, especially as the volatility gets larger as we go through this bull market we're in? And does that cause the spread to even blow out larger than what we're seeing right now? The locking up of coins on the physically settled exchange, is this almost like a second halving kind of event that's playing out in real time? Like, give us some of your thoughts on this.
I think it a kind of submarine issue to many people. Well, not issue. I mean, it's a positive driver, but it's not something that they would be visible to them necessarily, because it's kind of wrapped up in, you know, some kind of advanced trading strategies, and, you know, it's kind of mysterious. But it seems like it actually has the potential to be a kind of Bitcoin monetization driver, because people who are not even interested in Bitcoin can get an extremely high US dollar interest return.
30-40%.
Yeah, completely Bitcoin neutral. And so, you know, of course, once they realize that this is the case and that they can do these, take these kind of match positions on increasingly high tier platforms, more and more money will flow into that. So one theory could be that, and of course, there's enormous pools of money outside of the crypto space buying 30-year bonds at negative rates and things like that, right? So there's like a lot of money out there. So you would think that once the dam breaks and it flows in, the yields would slow down. But I think the problem is that it's the universe expanding.
So when you say that, intuitively, I agree with you. But in order for them to continue to participate, they're locking up more of the underlying as they come in and try to chase those spreads. And so right. If they're locking up more of the underlying, they're clawing it off the market, which is almost like it's supplying another halving or supply suffocation of the underlying coins, because the only way you can do these positions is you've got to put them in escrow, the underlying.
Right. Yeah. So I think there's some positive reinforcement loop where it's a mistake to think that, you know, let's say there's $4 trillion of demand to borrow dollars. And so, you know, there's only, let's say, half a trillion that is extant on crypto trading platforms. And so, you know, this is sort of demand to go leverage long, because many, you know, the people that are in Bitcoin generally want more Bitcoin or regret former conservatism. And so, and of course, there are speculators too, but, you know, there's clearly a high demand for leverage. And as there's a shortage of it, they bid the price up. And the problem is basically that people who have dollars on crypto exchanges would generally be inclined to market buy Bitcoin and hold it. So the only way you can persuade them to lend it to you is to bid the price up. And there's, you know, there's an oversubscription for that. And so you would say, well, you know, that there's so much demand now, there's more than that money outside the ecosystem. Once they overcome, there are many platforms where you can't count physical Bitcoin as collateral. So you've got to use other collateral. So that takes, you know, takes some of the fun out of it. But as you said, I think the thing is that it's not a stationary picture, because it's also, as more money flows in, it satisfies the demand to buy more Bitcoin and pushes the price up, locks up the physical Bitcoin for these yield strategies, which is, you know, more scarcity. Somebody wants to institutionally buy Bitcoin, where are they going to go, right?
Is it a perpetual machine? Once you get a physically settled derivatives market that's mature in place? That's the question I'm toying with. I have no clue what the answer is. And I don't know that there's any way that we could solve or say conclusively that that's what this is. But in a weird way, it's kind of looking like that's what's potentially the case here.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like there's some kind of hyper-Bitcoinization aspect to this, which is, it's just a self-feeding monster that wants to absorb all the money. And so basically what it's doing is it's just, you know, shifting the Bitcoin dollar exchange rate. As that changes, it can absorb more money because now the price per coin is higher. So it's not 4 trillion and it's 8 trillion and it's 20 trillion. And before you know it, you know, you have full-scale global hyper-Bitcoinization or something. So we'll see how it plays. And, you know, one interesting part about it, though, is that unlike the, you know, the kind of trader psychology that goes into pullbacks, and during a growth cycle like we're in now, there have typically been like a dozen, 10, 20, even 30% pullbacks on the way across, you know, 100x growth period or something, which we've seen in the past. And so, you know, people have to become accustomed to that. Some people panic sell or make other mistakes, over leverage, that kind of thing. But with the yield strategies, you're immune to that. These are, you know, largely immune to volatility. So long as the platform you're using is solvent, doesn't get hacked, and so that's where more mature platforms coming into play helps, then what's not to like about the yield in this environment? And so there's a reason for people to buy Bitcoin to collateralize the yield, the dollar yield collection. And so, you know, they don't even directly care about the price.
I mean, it's 10x, at least 10x right now on an annualized basis of what they're getting on any type of traditional government issued long-term bond. 10x. It's crazy.
Right.
Well, Adam, I could literally talk to you all day. Thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And I really want to do this again, because when I posted that I was going to be talking to you on Twitter, I think I had 300 or 400 people send me questions as to what they wanted us to talk about. So I would really enjoy if we could get back on and hammer through some of those questions if you're up to it. But either way, man, I am so excited and just want to thank you for your time to come on today.
Well, thanks for having me on. And let's indeed do that. Go through some interesting questions.
There was a lot of interesting questions there. Yes, sir. All right. Well, hey, we'll do this again. And thank you for your time today.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, so thanks for everybody listening into the show. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe to the show on whatever podcast app you're using. We really appreciate that. And if you have time, leave us a review. So thanks for joining us this week, and we'll catch you next Wednesday.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.